Your Public Health, a recurring monthly health update brought to you by the MATSU Public Health Center nurses, connecting you to your public health.
Hello and welcome to Your Public Health on Big Cabbage Radio, 89.7 FM. I'm Dr. Deb Gaidosh, public health nurse from MATSU Public Health Center in Wasilla. Today, Your Public Health is starting another aspect of our radio spot, and that is to share with you information about the collaboration with and the connection to our community partners. In our first program, we discussed public health work, and part of that work is to collaborate and interact with our community partners. Those partners can include public and private providers, other public health departments, public health nurses in clinics or villages, epidemiology, Alaska Family Services, WIC, Office of Children's Services, Denali Care, religious entities, just to name a few. Also includes post-secondary institutions as well as our K-12 schools, to name only a few of them. Today we will have one such community partner, Chef Rebecca Gaidosh-Rugi, the culinary arts teacher from the Tech High School in Wasilla, and also my daughter. Also joining us is my colleague, public health nurse Jamie Allison. In light of the holiday season, we thought it would be a good time to discuss foodborne illnesses and how through proper adherence to sound cooking practices, foodborne illness will not be a sad outcome to your holiday cooking, as well as how to recognize foodborne illness and some prevention techniques. So welcome, ladies, and thank you for both being here.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Jamie, I'll start with you. And I'll bet most of our listeners didn't know that public health nurses and the epidemiology nurses work closely together regarding communicable diseases, of which foodborne illness is categorized. Can you discuss for our audience what the public health nurse role is when we receive a report to investigate a foodborne illness at the MATSU Public Health Center?
Sure. When a person who lives in the MATSU tests positive for a communicable disease or a foodborne illness, the laboratory that ran that test will report the finding to the State of Alaska Section of Epidemiology. Our colleagues from the Section of Epidemiology send all that information to that patient's local health department. In this case, it would be the MATSU Public Health Center, where it's picked up by a public health nurse who begins an investigation to find out the who, when, where, and how of the infection. One of the first steps that the public health nurse will take is to call the patient and chat about all of the details surrounding their illness. Our goal is to trace the infection back to a source so that we can resolve the source of the infection and prevent additional illness. Bug chasing is interesting, but it's also a very important way that we keep our community healthy and stop the spread of disease.
I've done such investigations myself, and patients are always surprised when we do call. And we also make connections to the patient's provider to make sure that follow-up was done, that what type of health teaching patients received, and we generally augment that information so that they have a well-rounded source of information to protect themselves. Mm-hmm. I would venture that most folks most likely respond to the question of what is a foodborne illness with the general response of, oh, that's food poisoning. And while this has some validity, it really doesn't capture the breadth and depth of the various microorganisms such as bacteria, viruses, protozoans, and the specific disease each causes to contribute to the general term foodborne illness. Maybe you can, from your area of expertise, Jamie, explain the definition of foodborne illness, what it is, and what the most common types might be that we see most often here in the MATSU.
Mm-hmm. While most people may refer to foodborne illness as food poisoning, the actual definition is much broader. It's actually an infection or irritation of the GI tract caused by food or beverages that contain harmful bacteria, parasites, viruses, or chemicals. So eating a poisonous mushroom or a cereal that was contaminated with a fungicide would also be considered technically a foodborne illness. There are more than 250 identified foodborne diseases.
That's a lot.
Most often, though, people are thinking about common culprits of food poisoning like Salmonella. Here in the U.S., the top five germs that cause illness from food are norovirus, Salmonella, Clostridium, Campylobacter, and Staphylococcus, or what we just call Staph.
Mm-hmm. Lots of times you also see E. coli.
Yep.
And that comes across in unwashed fruits and vegetables. And recently we've had the discussion about the romaine lettuce and the CDC recommending that we discard any romaine lettuce that we have in the house, even if you ate part of it and nobody got sick. And that was a recent health concern. And we certainly have had calls at our health center about, should I throw out the romaine? And the answer is yes.
Yes.
Until the CDC says it's safe.
Right. And the most recent thing on that is just today, the CDC and the FDA said that romaine that is not from California is actually safe to eat. So they scaled it back just a small amount. But okay. If the romaine is from California, do not eat it. But a total of 43 people have become sick from this current E. coli outbreak in 12 different states.
Well, that's quite extensive. And Becky, you really do a lot of purchasing from our local stores. Did you notice if our romaine, does it come from California area? I would think that on the coast, we would probably get most of our fruits and vegetables there.
Right. It would make sense that it's coming from California, really, because it's our closest source of growth. It would be my assumption. And really, you can, that the purveyors that you're getting your food from, specifically you're looking at our local grocery stores, they're going to be up on whether or not the produce is coming in from an area that would be considered infected. So just look for signs locally. Another thing to be aware of is that if you do have lettuce that was contaminated and that you are having it to throw it away, is to also make sure that you are cleaning surfaces inside your refrigerator where the produce has lied, because you don't necessarily have microscope eyes. You can't see bacteria on a surface. So make sure you're cleaning up afterwards once you remove the product, so you don't accidentally reinfect or, put bacteria on something else.
That's a good tip, because we certainly don't think of our refrigerator as being a harbinger of bacteria until you actually see some kind of spill. But it could be there and we don't necessarily see it. So part of that certainly would be for our consumers to knowledgeable about looking at tags on the fruits and vegetables and where it comes from, so that you have some idea, especially when we have a cautionary tale from the CDC to limit some of those purchases depending on where the origin of the fruit or vegetable came from, in this case, the romaine. Usually when we do our investigations, the patient has been sick for a while. They sought medical care, and we most likely do the follow-up calls on them. When you do some of your investigations, what are some of the reasons that patients seek medical intervention with a foodborne illness?
The most common things that motivate people to seek care are usually stomach, upset stomach cramps, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and sometimes fever. With this E. coli outbreak, there's a particular strain that's causing more abdominal cramping and bloody diarrhea, and those symptoms are just more severe. So that's why more people have been seeking care during this current outbreak.
And certainly when I do my own investigations, when I talk about the symptoms and I say, and I'll ask a patient, well, tell me what made you go to the doctor, and they say, well, I was sick. It wasn't like, oh, I think I have something. No, there is something terribly wrong. And they are usually dehydrated and have a difficult time just having activities of daily life. So they know that they are sick and there is something going on that they need medical intervention. While most of these diseases can be self-limiting, sometimes antibiotics are ordered, and that's going to be on an individual basis on the clinical presentation of the patient, in my experience.
Yes, that's correct.
And certainly when we do call, we do the follow-up health teaching on things like how to prevent dehydration because of diarrhea, how to follow your doctor's orders, and any other health things that are useful in the home, like to inform people that as some of those microorganisms continue to slough off for weeks afterwards. So you have to be careful in your own home as far as washing your hands thoroughly after you use the toilet, how to keep your bathroom clean so you don't spread it from one person to the other, because that's miserable when it goes through the family. So we certainly do some of that health teaching. And thinking about these foodborne illnesses, there's also another form of, it kind of goes under a foodborne illness because of consumption, but what are other sources not specifically associated with food alone that causes some of these symptoms?
Certainly water is one of those. We are very fortunate to have an abundance of rivers, streams and lakes here in the Mat-Su, and many of us like to get out into the backcountry and enjoy these wild spaces. But water can be a source of infection if it has been contaminated with feces from wild animals, mm-hmm. pets, domestic animals, and certainly people. Giardia is one such parasite with a very hardy outer shell that can live in the drinking or recreational water, like swimming pools and lakes. Hikers, hunters, and campers certainly should use appropriate water filters to protect themselves, the people that they're outdoors with, and also their pets. Children should definitely avoid swallowing water while they're swimming, if that's at all possible. Mm. It certainly can continue to live in treated pools even, and certainly lakes and streams. But as always, good hygiene and cleaning up the feces of pets and people will reduce infections.
Yeah, when you think about that, try not to swallow the water thing. You realize how susceptible we really are to all of these illnesses that are out there. So it's important that we stay healthy, get exercise, eat well, get enough sleep so that our immune system is working at its top condition, because we do come across many, many microorganisms in our day-to-day life. And so we have to be in good shape in order to be able to withstand them. So shifting gears a bit, when we talk about foodborne illnesses from unsanitary conditions in food venues, and that could be anything from a local cart to a five-star restaurant. Mm-hmm. How I want to talk a little bit about how you can identify what some unsanitary conditions occur in different food venues from your experience, Beck.
Well, the biggest thing is unsanitary conditions in food venues vary, and the biggest reason for this is because we're dealing with the human element. We have people that are preparing and handling food, and if people are tending to small children or family who are sick during this season, as people tend to be, they're coming in contact with this fecal bacterial element, and that can be carried over into the workplace even if they aren't sick themselves. You can just be transporting them, right. Handling your money, touching your face, hair, nose, body. You know, a lot of times those actions are unconscious. We're just brushing hair out of our face. Then you directly touch, or you're prepping ready-to-eat products without washing your hands first. I mean, that's a big culprit of where foodborne illness comes from.
Oh, and that money thing.
Oh.
You don't really think about it, but money is filthy.
Oh, it's
when you think
gross.
About how many people handle the change and paper money that we handle, and then if you sit down and eat in a restaurant without cleaning your hands,
yes.
You are exposed to all of that. And so it's really astounding how much we come in contact with.
Mm-hmm.
But you were saying, what about cross-contamination?
Well, cross-contamination occurs if people aren't cleaning their hands or your surfaces as well as your utensils before moving on to different tasks. Buffets are where anyone can reach in and serve themselves is another place where you really are taking a risk when it comes to food. Sneeze guards are there to protect you from sneeze sprays, but people are still touching the handles of serving utensils. So if you see a spoon or a ladle that falls down into a container of food, the food should be thrown out. There's just no question about that. The risk is just too high for contamination.
And I've seen people fish the spoon out of the food
oh.
and then serve themselves, which makes me
yes.
kind of scream
oh,
inside
no,
my head.
Don't do it. Stop it. Just the inner scream for
right.
that. Just don't do that.
Right. And especially the little kids are helping themselves,
mm-hmm.
and little kids don't always have the cleanest of hands.
No, no,
and,
they do.
It's astounding that we're not sicker more times than we actually are. And the best place for any viruses to enter the body is through the nose and the mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And on average, one of the research articles I looked at had said that we touch our face and nose 2,000 times on average on a day. And people who wear glasses adjust their glasses so their hands always brought up to their face.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see how that is. There's a lot of truth in that.
Yeah, that's just that unconscious thing. There's lots of times I say to my kids, oh, you touched your ear. Go wash your hands. I did? Yeah, yes, you did. You don't even think about it.
Right, and it's something that we do all mm-hmm. the time. So in your culinary class with your students, do you teach about prevention of foodborne illnesses and what might be some important practices future chefs are required to know and engage in before they leave your class?
Okay, well, absolutely I do. The biggest thing I stress is excellent aseptic hand washing technique. This is highly effective. A lot of people take this for granted, but truly, it's really key. When I teach ServSafe and certifying my students, I'll actually stand in front of the sink and show them exactly how it must be done. There's a right way to wash your hands, and there's actually five steps for this activity we do all the time. Step one is wet your hands under
running water as hot as you can tolerate. Now, granted, we're not having like a manliness contest about how hot we can stand, but cold water is not going to really do the trick. So it's got to be hot water. Step two is lathering up with soap. Step three is scrubbing your hands between your fingers, in the crescents of your nails, up your wrists. And you have to do this for a minimum of 10 to 15 seconds. And I mean, it might feel like you're prepping for surgery, but really you think about like what your hands and your wrists come in contact with. It's worth the time to give it a little extra scrub. Step four is rinsing your hands and wrists, and step five is drying thoroughly with a single-use paper towel. A lot of times people will dry their hands on a cloth, wipe their hands on their shirt or the back of their pants, but really you're just adding lint and other bacteria back onto your hands and kind of negating what you just did. So
I know when I visit your classroom each year and teach about foodborne illnesses, and I bring up the hand-washing technique that your students are very well-versed in that.
It's A number one.
And when they complain and say, oh, well, we have to do this for 10 to 15 seconds, I remind them that surgeons do it from 5 to 10 minutes.
Yeah.
First time scrub in, they'll scrub in for 20 minutes. Yeah. So can imagine how long that is.
Right.
But they certainly know how to clean their hands when I'm there. Mm. What about hand sanitizers? Because we use them at our work, but we're not serving food. I always wonder if that sanitizer is on the hands when you're starting to handle food itself.
No, I mean, the thing is, hand sanitizers do not replace good hand washing technique. I mean, you can put it on. The time to put a hand sanitizer on is after you've washed your hands. It's not necessary, but it's not going to replace good hand washing. Hand wash every time. That's what we're going for. And hand washing and good personal hygiene, they all fall under that same umbrella. So clean clothes when you're preparing foods is good because you're not sprinkling like pet hair and goodness knows what else is stuck on your clothing into your food. I mean, don't change the oil of your car and then in the same clothes prep dinner. Also, if you can take off your jewelry on your hands and wrists too, do that as well. Because you got to think about like all those nooks and crannies that bacteria can hide inside a diamond setting of a wedding ring, for example. And that foul odor from your wristwatch at the end of the day, that's bacteria on your wrist from sweat and anything else that your hands come in contact with and that doesn't belong in your food for your family.
I'm always kind of amazed when we talk about that and when I do visit your classroom, how your world and my world come together because we don't wear jewelry either. We wash our hands constantly, even just dealing with patients on a daily basis. Somebody comes in, for instance, for a vaccine. Before the patient comes in, I wash my hands. When I draw up the vaccine, I clean my hands. Mm-hmm. When I finish with the vaccine and I put everything away before I give the injection, I wash my hands.
Right.
After the injection, I wash my hands, and we all do the same. By the end of the day, we're very chapped.
I will
in the
say
hands.
There's lots of lotioning involved, yes.
Yes. We spend a lot of time washing, putting on hand sanitizer, putting on lotion, and washing it off again.
Right.
Because we constantly do that.
Yep,
it's funny where our worlds interact a little bit on that.
Mm-hmm.
Another part that I know from my talking to you about food, because I've learned a lot over the years from you for a professional thing, is about temperature control and how that plays in the prevention of bacteria from growing in food.
Right. Controlling time of temperature is a really important factor when it comes to foodborne illnesses. There's this concept out there. It's called the time temperature danger zone. This is a temperature range from 135 degrees Fahrenheit to 41 degrees Fahrenheit. And what's important is that you need to heat or cool your foods quickly through this zone to prevent bacterial growth. Bacteria is most prolific at 125 degrees Fahrenheit. And bacteria will double every 20 minutes. That's each molecule of bacteria just exploding out. So if
that's astounding.
It really is. I try to draw it on the board for the kids, and after a while, it's like, look, I imagine it just continuing to expand. Mm-hmm. It's just more than I can even draw. If your compromised food hangs out in the bacteria zone at the right temperature, I mean, you really have this bacteria party just exploding in your food, and it's just not a party I don't want to attend. So a good rule of thumb is keep your food cool it down quickly within a four-hour time frame and store it under 41 degrees, which is definitely refrigerator temperature, and this keeps bacterial growth to a minimum.
And certainly some of those microorganisms that Jamie spoke about are opportunistic in that they will live in the environment that they are prolific in.
Oh, yes.
And lots of times they're the most happy in the human organism. That's us.
Well, we're the perfect temperature for that.
Right, so they go, oh, I found a home.
Mm-hmm.
So most of our food preparation is really done at home. What are some important techniques that you can share with our audience about how we can prevent foodborne illnesses in our very day-to-day lives? Mm.
I've said it before. I'll say it again. Hand washing. It's please do this, because there are the three most vulnerable groups when it comes to foodborne illness is the very young, the very old, and the immunocompromised. And at family gatherings where you're doing a lot of cooking, typically you have at least two of those three, group members there. You don't know just by looking at a person what they're fighting, so err on the side of safety and wash your hands. And also, if you have limited prep space in your home kitchen, prep ready-to-eat foods first. Ready-to-eat foods are foods that that when you're done prepping them, the next step is you just put the food in your mouth. Okay, so that's sandwiches, salads, desserts, completed dishes, etc. If the next step is eat, it's ready-to-eat food. So make sure that you're cleaning and sanitizing in between the prep of those dishes. Don't cut food on surfaces that have poultry or raw meat juices on them, because I mean salmonella is really serious, and you can get incredibly ill from just a drop of poultry juice. It's amazing.
Yes, when I did my research for the foodborne illnesses, I was astounded to find out that a drop of poultry fluids is enough to make someone very, very ill, which is why they're stored at the bottom of the refrigerator.
Absolutely. Poultry down below.
All right. So while we're talking about poultry, and that's a good one, because a lot of people use turkey as their holiday meals. The foods that contribute to foodborne illnesses like poultry and meats come to mind as major contributors. Since turkey is a food of choice for the holidays, as I said, discuss the safety prep time, and just so we have some cues for our audience, something that'll keep them out of the ER as a finishing touch to their holiday meal.
Yeah. I mean, I can't stress this enough. Please don't cook your stuffing inside of your turkey. I realize it's homey and it's quaint, but the reality is that you're sticking a dense bread product inside the cavity of a bird where all sorts of intestines used to be housed. I mean, looking at it from a practical, pragmatic standpoint,
that is nasty.
I know it takes some of the loveliness off of it, but
I would say so.
But I mean, really, realistically, you have a chance of cooking off a lot of bacteria by cooking your poultry to a minimum of 165 degrees. But your chance of success is lowered when you insulate that bird with a wad of stuffing, and then by the time the bird itself is 165 degrees, your stuffing is not hot enough on the inside, and that internal bacteria is now cooked directly into your stuffing.
Yum.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, stuffing hangs out in the danger zone and when it comes out of the bird. And then when you consume it along with your grandparents and children and others, you're looking at getting people sick. So what I would suggest then doing is cooking your stuffing on as a side dish covered with tin foil in the first part of baking, and then uncover it for the last 10 minutes just to give it a little toast on top. And just for the record, in case anyone wants to have a family debate on this, stuffing is when it's inside the bird and dressing is when it's next to the bird. But I'm going to tell you, go for dressing every time. Absolutely. Please do. So, and then when we're looking about for appropriate temps for cooking a really perfect turkey, season your turkey on the outside. I'll give you a little cooking tip. We'll go with that. Because for a good turkey, because sometimes turkeys get really dry. Okay. Season the turkey, start it out at 400 degrees to get a nice brown on the outside, and then drop the temperature to 350 degrees. If it looks like it's overcooking, tent it with some tin foil. Figure on about 15 minutes per pound for a thawed bird. And if your bird is still frozen, you might want to switch to another protein. Because it's really hard to effectively cook a frozen turkey. Mm-hmm. But you've got to make sure that your turkey temps out at 165 degrees and in more than one place on the bird. Check the breast first, which is the biggest muscle on the turkey, mm-hmm. For 165, and then check perhaps like the thigh, and then just kind of another place just to be consistent. But if that breast hits 165, you're probably okay. And then the last, as far as cooking goes, I'd say let your bird rest. If you let your turkey rest for a little while, all of the fluids that are flowing around inside the muscle will relax, and then it will stay contained inside of the muscle and leaving the bird to be very juicy. If you cut it right away, the juices just run out, and then you have a really, really dry turkey.
That's the hard part of our house.
Waiting.
Is the bird ready? Is the bird ready? It looks ready.
Yeah, stop
Should
touching
we cut it.
It
now?
Yes, leave it alone.
And what about the sides? The fruits and vegetables that we have, can some of that foodborne illness occur from these, and how can cooks prevent this as well?
It's food. You can get a foodborne illness from it. Once again, washing. Wash your produce.
Hence
the romaine problem. But I mean, even then, you really can't wash E. coli off of romaine. That's why the answer is just throw
it out.
Toss it out,
right.
Right. I mean, when you think about a grocery store and there's that human element again, people are touching produce to get the pieces they want. No one's selecting produce with gloves or tongs. They're using their bare hands. So if someone coughs on their hand, reaches into the apple pile and digs around to get the one that they want, now their chest cold's on a bunch of apples. Mm-hmm. Right. So even if you're not sick, but you're digging through the produce, remember, you're touching a shopping cart, and people touch those carts with their hands, and how much bacteria is on that cart. Fred Meyer's, I know, supplies like little sandy wipes to give you at least a fighting chance.
Mm. So most of the local stores
do. They do. So, mm-hmm. I mean, use them, because especially if you have like a baby who leans over and chews on the cart, and I've seen that, dirty hands that might have fecal matter on them touch those surfaces, and you don't have a clairvoyant relationship with the assorted produce in the store. You don't know who or what's been touching it, so wash your produce before you use it. Rinse it in cool water, air dry it, and prep on a clean surface with clean hands. And as a personal pet peeve, if I can throw in, please don't let your pets walk on the counters. It's cute, but they walk all over the floors, and they're not wearing shoes or socks. So think about cat litter on your cutting boards. It's pretty gross. Don't let your pets do that.
Yeah, that's a good tip, and I certainly hope that that doesn't happen. And while we learned about foodborne illnesses and some practices to prevent them, it is important that we recognize that there are some aspects of foodborne illnesses we cannot fully control when our food goes from farm to table. Think about how we as home cooks can't control the farm aspects. Think again about the romaine, the transportation and the cleanliness of the trucks and how long they're on the road, the factory connections, their health practices there.
And that's why it's really important to buy from an approved supplying source, because purchasing from casual home gardeners and things like that, you don't know what their practices are as far as fertilizing and harvesting and slaughtering if you're buying, you know, like mm-hmm. organic chickens from someone's personal farm. When we buy produce from a grocery store, we're looking at people that have been vetted, and they have to go through approved practices and whatnot, so everyone is safe. So it's worth thinking about.
Yeah, and it also puts another layer of protection there when we go to mm-hmm. Reputable places. So we have to be cautious in that chain of food handling, and certainly washing our hands and equipment thoroughly and frequently as we prepare our foods, being extra cautious with poultry and raw meats, as foodborne illness can be literally in our hands. I want to thank my colleague, public health nurse Jamie, and Chef Rebecca for their information and insight on the topic of foodborne illness and their prevention. And remind our listeners that Your Public Health will continue to be a monthly presentation airing each first Monday at 5 p.m. and Tuesday at 8:30 a.m. for the Matsu audience on Big Cabbage Radio, 89.7 FM. As we close, I want to wish our listening audience a happy and safe holiday season. And as always, remember, the public health works best when we all work together. Be well.
You've been listening to Your Public Health.